session number 9420, reel 13.
Mr. Bill Gilman, Reel 13. I wonder if you could continue with how you first heard of the armistice, Mr. Gilman.
Well, as I said, this was read out, this proclamation, and he's stating that the hostilities will cease from 11 that morning. And, of course, we had heard rumours for a couple of days that we'd really got Jerry on the run then. And, of course, this didn't really come as a surprise, and... Actually, there wasn't a cheer of any kind raised when that was read out. He just read this document out and said good luck and rode off with his officers, you know, and apparently he was trying to catch up the regiments that were on the march back, because in those days we had no transport, you know. It was all foot slogging. We were into Belgium then, and we finally wound up at a place where we were apparently to be billeted for, the regiment, at a place called Bazec. It's spelt B-A-S-E-C-L-E-S. And it's about 40 kilos from Valencia. And, of course, we all got billeted there. I was billeted in a what turned out to be a quarry owner's house where a German officer had been billeted. There was only one room there. Of course, everybody had to be billeted, and we were sorted out and just allocated, as we were told, at the various places to live there until we reported for parade duty, which was the usual way when we settled in anywhere if there was anybody living in the area. And it was funny because this turned out chap who owned this place, a fairly big, solid place, a good stand, you know, a good type of dwelling, and apparently he turned out to be a local quarry owner, very well known, and he had a daughter, and I'm afraid we fell for each other. And she was a lovely girl, and I remember her name was Celine. Wilbert, you know, it was either Wilbert or Gilbert, I'm not quite sure now because it's a little time ago. We fell for one another anyway. I was trying to learn French then because I was beginning to get interested naturally, and I remember that her uncle came along and who was a teacher, and I said, what was French for teacher? I'll never forget that, because We had difficulty in explaining how the word teacher was in French. It's instructrice, and I couldn't get this word right. And we tried several times, and I was always keen on language, and I was always sorry, you know, going through that and meeting some of the people, lads who'd been to a higher school or better education and had learnt French, you know. And I was always envious of them, really, that I couldn't speak in the language and realise what a loss of value it was. But anyway, we got to a very close stage. Nothing intimate, because they were very good living people, you know, and I don't know what religion they were, really. And I went to Valencia and got a ring for her, even. And it was a sort of engagement, you know. It was youthful seriousness, I suppose, when you look back on it, and after the aftermath of the war, as it were. And I know that they must have checked up on me, because he had business connections in England, and he must have let them know, because the communications were opening then, you know, and available. And this was some time afterwards, because we were there for a few months, I think. And I lived in a four-roomed house, very humble house. In fact, I lived in it for years, right up to the time I became mayor of West Ham. And now that is a long time, but it was, I was more concerned as a member of the housing committee at the time on the council, because I was into public life then.
But sticking to the story, what happened when they checked up on you?
Well, when, as I say, I was coming to that, when they found that I was lived in a humble place. It was a two up and two down with no front garden. Front of the house was on the pavement, one of those sort of areas, you know, and a poorish part of West Ham, although it was the centre of the town, Broadway. And apparently he gave a very bad report back. He judged me by the place that I lived in. He never made any inquiries, apparently, because I would have heard about it. I was very well known, being, you know, having lived there all that time. And her parents decided that I was not a suitable person, and they made her write to me and return the ring, and she was very upset and tearful about it, you know, and expressed it. I never kept the letter, of course. It was one of those things. Afterwards, I suppose it died off afterwards, but at the time, I mean, we were very close, and the thought got quite affectionate, you know, on a good standing. But when I did that, I just threw the ring away. I was, you know, in a temper about it, and because I thought it was so unfair, you know, to judge, to look, you know. She said, told me in the letter that her father's friend sent over from England a report of where I lived, and didn't think that I was a suitable person for her to continue relations with. Of course, funnily enough, you know, it's strange how life works out. If it hadn't have been for that, and we had have married, I'd have either been because she was the only child, I might have been the subsequent owner of a quarry, or she would have been the first lady in West Ham, which happened because I became the mayor, you see. So that's how life works out. It's so unexpected, the turns of life. You never know what's in front of you, and it fascinates you, really, when you go back over it and you see the picture as it emerged and as it could have been. And so that's the story of Bazic. And, of course, then I was sent on leave. We all had turns.
How did you feel about the end of the war yourself?
I don't know. I looked at it with mixed feelings. I had no... I think a lot that influenced me was that I wasn't linked up with anyone at home, only my mother. There was only my mother. My brother had got wounded in... He was in the artillery. He was 6 years older than me, so he was wounded early on in the artillery, and he was invalided out. And as I say, there wasn't much contact between us. And what happened was that I just took it in my stride. I mean, it was over, and we knew it had got to be over sometime or the other, and it had actually come to an end. It was hard to realise after continual fighting, you know, and all the things that war does bring with it, an action, you're concentrated on that and nothing else matters. But when then you get this vacuum sort of thing that happens to you, and that's what it did to me. Well, of course, the next thing happened was that I went on, came home on leave. I had a fortnight home on leave. Then when I reported back to the RTO at, I think it was Waterloo, he said, what regiment? I said, Royal Fusiliers. And he said, Marion Linden. And that was about 50, 60 kilometres the other side of Cologne. And that was the right at the extreme part that we occupied, you know, at the time, because we didn't go right across Germany. Crossing the Hohenzollern Bridge in when we marched across there, and then we felt, you know, top of the world, because we were the victors in the war, and then we did cheer and sing as we went along, and as I say,
What were your duties in Germany then? What were you actually doing at Marion Linden?
Well, actually, it was supposed to be my return on leave to my regiment, which I'd left in Bezek, you see. And as I say, this was the regulars, and I was a territorial City of London Fusiliers. And that when I said Fusiliers, I should have said City of London. I didn't. They thought I was regular, so they sent me to Maryland where the regular Fusiliers were. When I got there, they said, "We don't know." When they looked up the records, they said, "We can't trace you as having been a member of the..." What battalion were you in? I said, "The 2nd City of London." He said, "This is the regulars."
So that was the 2nd?
Hmm?
That was the 2nd battalion at Marion Linden, was it?
No, I don't know what battalion that was. I mean, they just sent me... Well, I can't remember, to be honest. I might have known at the time, you know, and found out it probably was either the regular 2nd or 4th or something like that. But anyway, I can't remember, to be honest, and... All I knew was that he said, we can't put you on parade here. He said, "You just muck around and find yourself some food at the cookhouse," he said, "and join in any response or recreational activities." As a matter of fact, I entered for the swimming race in a relay they had in the Hagger, which was a tributary of the Rhine. And I remember that we won that race, and before the prize day was fixed for giving us prizes for this relay race. I don't know what they were going to be, you know, but anyway, we beat the other local regiments which were stationed round there. And I got recalled into the office, and they said, "Well, your regiment that was at Bezek has been disbanded, and you now got the choice. You can be demobilised," he said, "or we've got vacancies in the train crew company." And that was a company that had been formed of any regiment, composed of any volunteers who didn't particularly want to be demobilised for one reason or another. Like myself, I hadn't got any particular reason for going home, and I was enjoying things as they were, because I'm that sort of character, you know, take things in my stride. And so I opted for the train crew company, and that consisted of, as I say, of these various people. We were allocated the troop trains that used to be the ambulance trains. They were British trains. They were the best ones, better than the French, and they used to carry the troops then on leave from Cologne to Calais.
Where were you based? Cologne still?
Yes, at Marion Linden I was then, you see. And because they were waiting, when they found out I was in the wrong regiment, they said, "Now, what do you want?" So I opted for the train crew company, and then I reported then to Cologne, to the train crew company. They gave me a chit, you know, and I went to, and I was allocated to the Julienne. That's on that picture, that card.
That's the name of the train.
They were all named after French girls, Julienne, the Mademoiselle, or the Madeleine, and there was one or two more. And I got allocated to a general's coach, you know, where a special little compartment at the end where I had the bell fixed up so that they summoned me when they wanted anything and all that. And I had a while of a time there. And we used to travel between Calais and Cologne, and we got a bit of a joke about that, because where the lines, the railway lines, were jointed, it used to be Calais Cologne, Calais Cologne, Calais Cologne, as we used to ride along in the train, you know.
What did you actually do on the train? What were your range of duties?
Well, we looked after the generals, you know, that we used to clean their compartment out because they were bedded down. It was very nicely fixed up. I could only speak for my own, but they all had their various allocations on the train, and there was all sorts of arrangements and facilities on the train, like postal facilities there, you know, for delivering posts. We had to see they got their post and sort of their meals as well. We were more or less a jack of all trades, like almost like Batman, You see, in my case, I was a sort of amateur backman, because this is the first experience I'd ever had of serving close to anyone of rank at all. It had usually been on the order, getting the orders end of it. And now, of course, they were more or less requests done in the usual manner that the officers had with their own batmen, you know. And I thoroughly enjoyed that. Of course, we used to flog the stuff. We used to buy things. The rate of marks was about 400 to the franc. You know, they were in a terrible state in Germany, you know. I mean, the girls were selling themselves more or less for chocolate and cigarettes and all that kind of thing. And they were in a very bad way, and they were short of everything. And that was the first time I ever came into contact with black bread, because that's all the Germans had. And the tin stuff, the bully beef, you know, you could get any amount of marks for it, you know. And of course, what we could buy in France and or with Germany and get the benefit of the rate of exchange. I mean, some of us did well. I bought an accordion, and lovely accordion in Cologne, and I learned to play it as well. And brought it home with me. I had it for years here. And camera, I've got a camera with a Zeiss lens, and I had that for years, and I used to take photos when I came home, and wedding groups and so forth. So that was the souvenirs that I got from there.
How did you get on with the German population, civilians?
Very good, very well. I can't speak too well of them. They turned out of their bed for us at any time there was a difficulty. I mean, I don't know whether it was when we were settling in or anything like that, or it was in the case of moving around. But I remember they did. One of them turned out their bed for me, you know, for me to keep down. And they were glad the war was over. They were weary of it, you know, and they had so many losses like we had. But of course, we were on their ground, and what they were expressing to us, I realised that our people were expressing to our own among themselves about the heavy losses, because the losses were tremendous at the time. And there was hardly a family in any street that hadn't suffered casualties of some kind, death or wounded or something of that. And of course, that's what happened. And then, as I say,
there was no friction at all then with...
No friction, whatever. Oh, there was one occasion... yes, there was one occasion that happened. We went into a beer house, I remember, with some colleagues. They were colleagues from the train crew company. And we had some pretty wild heads there, you know, amongst us. And the drink got to them much. I didn't drink a great deal, but... And I never been drunk in my life. I was always jealous about not losing control of myself, you know, not knowing what I was doing, because I saw some silly examples of them drinking and how people behaved and that. And it didn't appeal to me much. And to be honest, I never found a drink that I really loved, you know, that you would make me go to lose me or overdo it. But anyway, we went into this pub, and of course, there were some Germans in there, road sweepers they were, because they came in there with their shovels and brooms. And they were drinking at the bar, and I don't know who started it. They either our people, they were saying, you know, how do you like your eggs boiled, Jerry? And all some of them who knew English, they took it up and translated it. And, of course, it started in no time, and they made a rush, you know. I know I picked up a little three-cornered marble top table. I swung it round to get out there, because they were jamming, trying to cut us off from the door. And of course, our blood was up then. You know, we weren't going to take this after giving them a thrashing in the war. And so some of our lads, they loved a scrap and all that. And to me, it was self-preservation. Of course, I let go and... We got out there, but they chased us down the road. And I'll never forget, there was a little Scot. He was only about 4'3". He was the smallest fellow, you know, we had in the train crew company that I met there. And he belonged to the he was on the Julienne with me. And I remember when we got back, he said, "Oh, Bill," he said, "I'm going back." I said, I lost my hat. I lost my hat. I said, "Never mind about your bloody hat, Jock." I said, "Let's get out of here." And we did. We actually ran away from that. That was what upset us most. We had to run from them, you know, instead of establishing the position that we'd have gained through the war. It was that sort of atmosphere, you know.
But that was a one-off incident.
It was a one-off. That was the only time I encountered any friction between ourselves and the Germans. Other than that, I remember I was invited, I don't know how it came about, but I was invited to the home of a family where a fellow who lived in London, a German, and he spoke perfect English. You couldn't fault him. You'd think he was an Englishman the way he spoke. He was in their Air Force as an interpreter. You know, when the airmen came down, they used him, he told me, because he said he loved London. He told me all about places that I knew in London, Piccadilly and all those places, you know. And Bow, he knew Bow and Mile End. And I told him that we'd had, you know, the Zeppelins over, and they'd bombed us once or twice. So he said, "It's a sad thing, you know." He was a very sensible German. He understood, being able to speak the English and lived with us, he could understand the same as you do. You know, you get a good assessment of the character of people and nationalities.
Did you notice anything about political events in Germany at that time?
No. No, there was nothing at all. And of course, I wasn't looking for that. I hadn't even entered into politics at that time. I'd been in a trade union, you know, before I joined up. But politics, no, I hadn't. I was, you know, in my early teenage then. So there was nothing brought up of a political nature at all. Only the general agreement on all sides where we could make each other understood when we were talking to Germans that how useless war was, you know, and why did it have to happen? Because we all knew that it was brought about by individuals who'd got power which they misused and had started something, and these things started from silly beginnings like that war did, you know. Through an agreement and people were overriding.
Did you feel at the time in Cologne and elsewhere that you'd been fighting a war to end wars? Was that something you felt you'd been doing?
Oh, yes, we thought that this was going to... there wouldn't be any more wars like this, you know, as far as we could feel the thing.
Had you been told that, or was it something you felt within?
No, we felt that. We felt when we were talking among ourselves, you know, the boys, we used to say, "Christ, they won't have any more wars like this." You know, I think they think more sensibly about what happens and the death and destruction that takes place, because we gave him a bashing, you know, as we did on both sides. And of course we'd seen all the destruction of the villages as we went through, and on fire and people losing their homes and terrible death. You know, civilians lying about shot. I remember going over a bridge when they'd taken their shoes and socks off. They'd been stripped by the Jerrys because they hadn't got even boots when we got them on the run. And that was when we got across a bridge. I forget what river it was, but there was, I remember, couple of these civilians lying.
You felt that the example of what had happened would deter anybody in future. That was how you felt it would end.
Yes, well, you always get that impression. Whenever you run in, I've found that through life, and I've lived a long time now, and I've found that through life, that when there's anything very drastic has happened, you've always felt that there couldn't be anything worse than that, and that it couldn't happen again. But it does, you see, and it's all through some nothing that's been thought out and planned. Nothing that's been planned. It's been something that's been quite out of the blue that nobody would dream of being the start of such a holocaust as that war, same as that assassination in Sarajevo, you know, which started the last war.
How long were you in this train company with the Giulio?
Well, as soon as I got back on leave, as I say, I was allocated to it, and I should think that was around the early part of 1919, and I carried on then right up to May 1920.
So over here.
They were constantly taking people on leave to the various places we'd occupied along in Germany and round there. And, of course, they then discontinued the train service because it was gradually getting back to normal, as far as you can call normal, with an occupying force, to straighten things out. And they didn't require these. As a matter of fact, they were glad to get the trains back into England again. And they were our own British trains. And, of course, we wanted it. We were much in need of rolling stock and other things and getting back to normal is what the Germans were, you see.
When the time for demobilisation came, were you still enjoying army life?
Yes, I enjoyed that. To be truthful, I suppose you could say I'm an easygoing bloke. I've taken everything in my stride, as I did then, and it was, of course, very valuable to me, as it turned out, because it was an early experience. It was hardening to me, the experience of the war, and having to practice undergo enforced self-preservation. And it hardened me to that extent that I was a lot older in experience than I was in age. And I used to cope with things much more easily. And when I got home, it made it easier for me to cope because there couldn't have been anything worse than the trench life that I'd been leading and the war and all its actions and involvement. And so I just took it in my stride. I enjoyed everything I did.
So you felt the war had been, in a way, a valuable experience to you?
I thought when you stopped and thought about it in a quiet moment or two, I thought that, well, it's an experience that I would never have had otherwise, you know, in the process of growing. And, of course, what struck me more vividly and then thing and brought it home to me, the effect of it, was the fact that when I actually got demobilised at Purfleet, and was given my civilian suit, and I was given the option of keeping my army overcoat, which I did, and I rode in that on my bike to the Great Eastern Works when I got a job back on the railway. And what struck me most was that nobody wanted to know. Before I got on the railway, I was out of work 18 months, and we had to dig holes to get stamps on our cars.
Were you ever tempted to stay on as a regular?
No.
Why not, if you enjoyed it so much?
Well, there wasn't much point in it, really. I mean, I wanted to get home to civil life, you know, as we all did. We'd all had... The whole of our lives had been spent there in action, and we'd had a bit of a sweetener afterwards, as in my case, anyway. But a lot of them who took demobilisation before me, they'd snapped up whatever jobs that were going. And when I got out, I mean, there wasn't anything for me, and I was out of work 18 months over it.